Good morning and welcome to our seventh lecture. We will deal with the Geneva years. Mises spent 6 years of his life in the southern Swiss city of Geneva. He left Vienna in 1934 and taught then at a chair at the Graduate Institute of International Studies from the fall of 1934 to the spring of 1940, and then moved on to the US, which will be our subject tomorrow. Why did Mises leave from Austria? Well, there were several reasons. First of all, he qualified for early retirement, so there was certainly a temptation for him to use the opportunity and focus entirely on his scholarly interests. After all, his Chamber of Commerce activities had given him some prominence and, of course, especially an income, but his main interests were intellectual, and so it would have offered him an opportunity to finally write a comprehensive treatise on economics, and that's what he did, in fact, during these Geneva years. He prepared his book Nationale Economie, which was the predecessor of Human Action, so a 700-page book. But there were other reasons as well. So, I mean, he did not have to starve in Geneva either. He received a very attractive offer. So it was not just a little stipend, but he had a full salary there that was comparable to the salary that he had in Vienna. The offside was that it was just a one-year contract, but eventually the contract was renewed six consecutive times. So he stayed 6 years. And then last but not least, there was also the fact that life in Vienna became increasingly unpleasant, and this was due to the fact of the rising power of the Nazi Party within Austria. Now, we need to make a fine distinction here. The rise of the Nazi Party means the rise of the power of the Austrian branch of the NSDAP, that is the National Socialist Party under Hitler in Germany. It does not mean the authoritarian government of Engelbert Dollfuss. So Austria had from 1934 to 1938, to the Anschluss, the annexation to Germany, had an authoritarian government that ruled more or less dictatorially. But this was not the Nazi Party, although, of course, some of our left-wing or extreme left-wing colleagues tend to conflate the two. Well, it's not at all the same. The authoritarian Dollfuss Party, party's main mission was to preserve Austria's independence. And the Nazis, of course, wanted precisely the opposite. They wanted to integrate Austria into Germany. And in this, paradoxically and or ironically, they were united with the Social Democrats. In fact, the Social Democrats, of course, they felt uneasy about this in those days, because integrating Austria into Germany in 1934 would have meant subjecting Austria to Nazi rule. That was, of course, not what they wished to do. But until the end, in fact, of World War II, the Austrian Social Democrats were a larger German party. Right? They were German nationalists. They were not Austrian patriots. So we had this Austrian patriotic party of Dollfuss, which was in the process of becoming a minority, and therefore decided to use its power and to rule dictatorially. It was not democracy, but it was not a Nazi party. Well, in any case, so the Nazis were rising in power, and Mises felt, well, that storm clouds were approaching Vienna, and so there was an additional incentive for him to leave. He therefore accepted very readily an invitation by William Rappard, who was the president and founder and director of the Graduate Institute of International Studies in Geneva. Rappard wrote to Mises in the spring of 1934, and Mises more or less replied immediately, accepting this proposition. Geneva was, in those days and still today, a center of international organizations, the first international organization, in fact, the very first international organization was the International Red Cross, which had its headquarters in Geneva already before World War I. And then after World War I, there were two other institutions that were set up in Geneva. The first one was the International Labour Office, established in 1919, which still exists today, of course. And the League of Nations, established in 1920, at the initiative of Woodrow Wilson, the American president. And finally, the U.S. did not join the League of Nations because Wilson did not get the support of the Parliament, of Congress. Now, why Geneva? Well, Geneva was in Switzerland, so a neutral ground, traditional Swiss neutrality. And then it was also a French-speaking town, so it was easy to command the adherence of the French war ally. Now, these international organizations needed qualified personnel, personnel trained in political science, economics, social sciences in general, but also with certain language capacities, as they needed to be able to speak both English and French at a very minimum, and if possible, other languages as well. So there was a need for a special bilingual school, which was perceived by Rappard. Rappard was a contemporary of Mises, born in 1883, and he died in 1958. He was an economist, historian, who made a was first of all a brilliant and impressive personality, tall and charming, and spoke, I don't know, five or six languages. And he was a brilliant scholar as well, who had excellent connections already before World War I. He had been visiting professor at Harvard, where he met Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was his colleague for a few years. So you can imagine what this meant then for Rappard's standing during the war, and then in the immediate aftermath of the war. He had big leverage on the decisions that were being made in Geneva. And it certainly helped to establish the school, which was then founded in 1927 with the help of another wartime acquaintance, namely Paul Mantou, an economic historian, also very much appreciated by Mises. And the institute was created as a joint venture of the University of Geneva. In the year in which it was created, Rappard was the rector of the University of Geneva. So we might guess that one of the reasons that prompted him to be elected to be a candidate for rector was that precisely he wanted to establish the school. So take the head of the university and then strike a deal to set up this institute. And the other partner in the joint venture was the Rockefeller Foundation. We already talked a little bit about the Rockefeller Foundation, the reason for its emergence, and said, well, the Rockefeller Foundation financed especially business cycle institutes those years, but the Rockefeller Foundation financed virtually the entire League of Nations. Well, not 100%, but to a large extent. And in the case of the Graduate Institute of International Studies, the Rockefeller Foundation contributed approximately 50% of the budget, and in some years more. So we have here a financial connection, between Mises and the Rockefeller Foundation. I mentioned yesterday that Mises got in personal contact with these people on his 1926 trip to the United States. He was then the Vienna referee of suitable students to receive scholarships from the Rockefeller Foundation. And in the early 1930s, then when the Nazis rose to power in Germany, 1933, several Jewish or left-wing intellectuals had to leave Germany, Mises was instrumental in finding for them new positions in Anglo-Saxon countries. And these positions were, as a rule, financed, at least in part, by the Rockefeller Foundation. So Mises was again an important intermediary here, and it was therefore only natural that at some point he would also benefit from their support. And we'll see that this connection held on through to his arrival in the United States. In fact, the first 4 years of his stay in the United States, he was again financed essentially by the Rockefeller Foundation, though less enthusiastically. So Mises held the chair for international economic relations for 6 consecutive years. His predecessors on this chair had been Patterson, Graham, and Viner, so 3 American economists. He knew these economists well from conferences and so on. He had known Rappard from the very early days in Vienna. And he had known other visiting professors at the Graduate Institute, such as, for example, Theodore Gregory, whom he had known through the connection to the London School of Economics. So all these came together and paved the way to Mises' departure for Geneva. How do we have to imagine academic life at this school? Well, first, the most important thing to grasp is here is the sheer numbers. It was a small school, only 100 students, 50 of which were doctoral students. A faculty of 12. And now, hold your breath, an administration of 6 heads. Okay, 6. Now that's, of course, in our days we can barely imagine this, right? I mean, if 3 students, then you need at least 10 administrators. Maybe 1 professor. So in those years, there were much more healthy proportions, and essentially everything was done by the professors themselves. Mises found good friends not only in Rappard and Montu, so those academics who led the institution, but also in Maurice Bourquin, who was a professor of diplomatic history, in Guglielmo Ferrero, an Italian professor of modern history, and of course in his friends, old-time friends, Kelsen, Hans Kelsen, and Gottfried von Haberler. These people very often came to the school, stayed at the school because of political pressure in their home countries. In the first few years of the operation of the institute, people would stay just for a year, but then people would eventually stay on. And those who stayed on came essentially from Germany and from Italy. So Rappard said, sometimes jokingly, well, thanks be to Hitler and thanks be to Mussolini. He gave us all these great scholars. They could no longer stay in their own countries. They had to go somewhere else, so they came and stayed here. But there were also other Rockefeller-funded groups in Geneva, as I've pointed out, at the League of Nations, for example. There was an Economics Intelligence Unit, there was the International Labour Office, and there was a Geneva Research Center. And so all these people, therefore, cooperated more or less spontaneously. There was certainly, we must imagine, that there must have been functions, organized parties given by the Rockefeller Foundation and so on. And in any way, they had fairly similar research interests. Each professor at the school chose the subject of his courses and seminars. Now, that's of course an academic paradise. Okay? And the amazing thing is that it worked. It did work. And all this at a very comfortable salary. Mises had a contract providing for 25,000 Swiss francs per year. Now, I retranslated this into ounces of gold. Okay, so, because ounces of gold still exist today, so it gives us a rough idea. So this was roughly 234 ounces of gold per year. Now if we calculate this times, what is it today, 700, and 7 times, so 140,000, more than $140,000, $160,000 approximately. Okay. just to have an idea. And at the time, it was $8,200. Okay? Now you see what has become of the US dollar. So Mises chooses his classes. He teaches approximately 3 hours per week. It's not too much. So essentially, he can concentrate on research. And from time to time, he is obliged to teach an economics class, a basic economics class for the new students. And so, but this is not every year, so he shares the task with other economics professors. Mises teaches in English. Now, that's an interesting fact with important historical repercussions, as we now know, because he eventually moved to the U.S. So he chooses English. English was not his main foreign language. He was fluent in French. So we must have imagined him speaking French with an accent, but he spoke French very well and fluently. He did not speak English very well and fluently. So why did he do this? The professors were free to pick their language. They could teach either in French or in English. And in the practice of the class, well, it was so that it was really a bilingual school. So even if the professor teaches in French, then students could ask a question in English. And he would reply in French. Okay? And so it was a mixture. As long as you asked and replied in any of these two languages, it was okay. Written works could be authored in other languages too. So you could also write your thesis and your doctoral work and so on in German and in Italian. Okay? So it's fairly a cosmopolitan school. And, well, Mises, so he chooses English because he thinks, well, one of the consequences of Hitlerism, as he writes to Fritz Machlob at the time, is to destroy the international importance of German. Okay, and of course he was right. But he sees it immediately, right? That's the consequence. German will become unimportant, and English will rise in importance because all these people who had to leave, all the intellectuals who had to leave from Austria and in Germany in particular, well, they predominantly went to the Anglo-Saxon countries. So a reinforcement of the importance of English. Now, in order to get an idea of how his English mustered, it was not very good, okay? It was not very good, and he wrote all his talks out in full. So he created a manuscript and then read his manuscript. Okay? Now, how must this have sounded difficult to imagine, but what we'll do now is to listen to a tape recording of a 1958 talk that he gave at a Mont Pelerin meeting at Princeton University. So that means after 18 years of sojourn in the U.S. and after more than 24 years of teaching in English and speaking, using the English language regularly. So we'll listen to this now. So these are pictures from the talk. So one of the most sympathetic pictures that we have of Mises, very spontaneous. Usually, if he stands like this, a knight, right? A knight. And here he is relaxed. Look at this. This is great. And smiling. And yeah, it's a pity that not more pictures like this. So we are now listening to him as he speaks.
With the eyes of these Greek and Roman writers, freedom was not something that had to be granted to all men. It was a privilege of a minority to be withheld from the majority. What the Greeks called democracy was, in the light of present-day terminology, not what Lincoln called government by the people, but oligarchy, the sovereignty of the full-right citizens in a community in which the majority were metakes or slaves. Even this rather limited freedom, after the 4th century before Christ, was not dealt with by the philosophers, historians, and orators as a practicable constitutional institution. As they saw it, It was a feature of the past, lost forever. They bemoaned the passing of this golden age, but they didn't know of any method of returning to it. The second notion of liberty was no less oligarchic, although it was not inspired by any literary reminiscences. It was the ambition of the landed aristocracy, and sometimes also of urban patricians, to preserve their privilege against the rising power of royal absolutism. In most parts of continental Europe, the princes remained victorious in these conflicts. Only in England and in the Netherlands did the gentry and the patricians succeed in defeating the dynasties. But what they won was not freedom for all, but only freedom for an elite, for a minority of the people.
Liberty. Was not very clear. I hope you heard it more. The speakers were over there. Hope you heard it a little bit more than I did, although I knew the tape already. But you see, so he had a very strong accent, still in 1958. His whole intonation is still colored by his Austrian origin, right? So it's far from being fully assimilated, and it never would. So we can imagine how it must have been in 1934 when he gave his first year of courses. Okay, so we have here, of course, a very strong disincentive for the students to take part in his classes. Right, a strange guy, and you hardly can understand him. Right, and so how come that he had any impact at all? Now we have a very interesting document that testifies to the impact that he would have, or the impression that he would create in his lectures, namely in the form of a student evaluation written by a student who attended the institute, an American student who attended the institute in 1935 to 1936, so in the second year of Mises' sojourn. And when he returned to the US, he wrote this report, and it was then forwarded back to Switzerland as a feedback to the institute. And there's one passage in this report that concerns Mises. I'll read this for you now. So the student writes, "I have gradually come to the conclusion that Professor Mises ranks as one of the best here as an analyzer of current economic problems. The title of his course is likely to have little relations to the topics treated. But his lectures are always stimulating and lucid, and as a unique feature, always carefully written out in advance. His English leaves a good bit to be desired from a grammatical point of view, and a first impression is likely to be unfavorable. However, his vocabulary is rich, and his meaning always clear. In short, he wears well. And for those interested in the economic riddle left by the breakup of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, he has an especially valuable contribution to make. Best of all, he is able to enliven his discussions and lectures by concrete experience and first-hand observations drawn from wide travel and research on the spot." Okay, so that's Mises, that's the impression that Mises creates. But again, right, even in the Geneva years, there's no Mises school that emerges for various reasons. Well, one was so his limited abilities as a speaker. Only if you attended his classes thoroughly, well, you came maybe like this American student to the conclusion that he wears well. But then also we must consider the motivation of most of those students going there. They're not per se interested in economic theory. They don't want to be academic economists. They do want to join one of these international organizations. Okay, now comes Mises, who is a classical liberal, and well, and the practical offshoot of his teachings is, well, there's not really much that government can do. Mostly they overdo it. They're just in the way. They're counterproductive. Now that's not very likely to be a welcome message to these young people who go there precisely because they're full of the conviction, as he himself had been when he was young, right, that something needs to be done and the government should run the show. Okay. So we have here another explanation. And then, of course, again, his encompassing treatise of economics does not yet exist. So cannot train them based on this. He can train them on the basis of his publications, which were essentially in German. And only in those years we have the first English translation coming forward. 1934 appears the translation of his Theory of Money and Credit. 1936, a translation of his book Socialism. Now the impact of these writings is also mitigated by the fact that they coincide with the Keynesian Revolution. So 1936, of course, the year in which Keynes' general treatise appears. So we might raise the question, what did Mises think about the general theory? Not much, of course. But how precisely did he react? Well, he did not comment on this book when it appeared. He reacted only when the Keynesian movement came into full swing and elevated the British economist to the status of a guru of the profession. In Mises' eyes, the Keynesian Revolution was insignificant from the point of view of the history of ideas. Keynes had not brought forth a single new doctrine. At the onset of the Keynesian Revolution, in fact, a few eminent historians of thought had pointed out that Keynes' view about the relationship between variations of the money supply, employment, and output had been anticipated and stressed in mercantilist thought. And those of you who are interested, you're going to read Elie Heckscher's book on mercantilism and also Jacob Weiner's studies in the theory of international trade. The implication is, of course, that Keynes was not so much a revolutionary, but a reactionary champion of the Ancien Régime. And Henry Hazlitt later published, for those of you who are interested, we have this book here on sale too, and point-by-point refutation, a critique, analysis and critique of the general theory. And he confirmed this implication in rather devastating terms. Here's what Hazlitt said. Now, though I have analyzed Keynes's general theory in the following pages, theorem by theorem, chapter by chapter, and sometimes even sentence by sentence, to what some readers may appear a tedious length, I have been unable to find in it a single important doctrine that is both true and original. So, even Keynes's major fallacies were old and had been refuted hundreds of times. The proper deal to deal with Keynesianism, therefore, was to consider it from a sociological point of view. And as an intellectual matter, from a scholarly point of view, well, it was a death birth. Okay. So why is it such a success? This requires an explanation. And here's what Mises wrote a few years later in 1948. For a correct appraisal of the success which Keynes' general theory found in academic circles, one must consider the conditions prevailing in university economics during the period between the two wars. Among the men who occupied the chairs of economics in the last few decades, there have been only a few genuine economists, that is, men fully conversant with the theories developed by modern subjective economics. The ideas of the old classical economists, as well as those of the modern economists, were caricatured in the textbooks and in the classrooms. Well, for those of you who are economic students, you know that things have not changed much. They were called such names as old-fashioned, orthodox, reactionary, bourgeois, or Wall Street economics. The teachers prided themselves on having refuted for all times the abstract doctrines of Manchesterism and laissez-faire. And 2 years later, Mises then added the following observation. The great classical economists were harbingers of new ideas. So Keynes was a reactionary. Adam Smith was a true revolutionary. The economic policies they recommended were at variance with the policies practiced by contemporary governments and political parties. As a rule, many years, even decades, passed before public opinion accepted the new ideas as propagated by the economists and before the required corresponding changes in policies were effected. It was different with the new economics of Lord Keynes. The policies he advocated were precisely those which almost all governments, including the British, had already adopted many years before his general theory was published. Keynes was not an innovator and champion of new methods of managing economic affairs. His contribution consisted rather in providing an apparent justification for the policies which were popular with those in power, in spite of the fact that all economists viewed them as disastrous. His achievement was a rationalization of the policies already practiced. And that was it. So there's no more comment on Keynes, right? For example, you will search in vain for such lengthy passages in Human Action. These are shorter papers that Mises wrote elsewhere. He just, again, so the reason is that he found that Keynesian economics was irrelevant from an intellectual point of view. Now, in the Geneva years, we might mention, okay, apart from his activities in the school, there was one thing that is quite charming that we may mention here, namely that he found a new hobby, which was driving a car. Okay, so Mises started taking driver's lessons, driving lessons in 35 or 36, and in the fall of 36, he bought a Ford vehicle with the name Grand Tourism Lux, for which he paid about one quarter of his salary, annual salary. Okay, and so he shared this with great enthusiasm, first with colleagues, right, took them on rides, they drive into Italy and into France. And later on he would take out Margaret for rides, and she would enjoy it too, and they would spend many, many happy hours on the road, and had three severe accidents in the course of time. Yeah, he was not a very good driver. He was a bad dancer, he was also a bad driver, but he enjoyed both. Okay, Mises made in the fall of 1937, after some 3 years or so, Mises made plans to return to Vienna. The reasons were that there were financial difficulties of his school. So in particular, the Rockefeller Foundation threatened with the withdrawal of its funds, too much money, and there's not enough coming out of this. And then Rappard does was what any academic administrator would do. Well, he organized conferences and organized publications, collective publications. Right? Because, people were not publishing enough. So it was nice books on international economic problems being published in 1937 and 38. But there were also other reasons, namely in particular that Mises received a very attractive proposition from his old employer in Vienna. More precisely, there was a reorganization of the Chamber of Commerce organization within the entire country. Before, you just had local chambers of commerce, and the most important one was the Chamber of Commerce in Vienna, for which he worked. But then in the mid-1930s, all chambers of commerce in Austria were reorganized into a central organization. And so they created a central chamber of commerce for all of Austria, which they called the Federal Chamber, the Bundeskammer. Now, Mises was approached to be appointed the head of the Department for Monetary and Financial Affairs of this new federal chamber. And, of course, it would have been also interesting from a financial point of view. It's interesting because you have greater prestige and impact on policies. And so he was probably not only, he was certainly considering it, but probably not only considering it, but also making active steps to taking up these this new position after the academic year 1937-1938. And the reason why he didn't do it finally was because the German army marched into Austria in March 1938. Okay, it was the famous Anschluss. For reasons that we do not have to analyze now, essentially what had happened was Austria was independent in those few years from 1934 to 1937, because it had the support of Italy. Okay, Hitler and Mussolini were not buddies from the outset, and Mussolini did not want to have the Wehrmacht on his northern frontier. So when Hitler, after rising to power, threatened to invade Austria, and there were several situations of this sort, one important one in 1934, well, Mussolini brought the Italian troops to the Brenner, to the frontier, the southern border of Austria. That it was clear that he would have marched into the country too to prevent that the German army moved to the Italian frontier, to the Italian border. So Austria was ruled in those days by an autocratic regime, dictatorial regime, and was pursued a policy of independence, but which it could not sure out of its own forces, but which relied on the support of the Italians. Now, Italy lost its interest in this matter. Italy joined Germany as an ally, so abandoned its policy of opposition and joined Germany as an ally in the fall of 1936, when the Italians invaded a country at the time that was called Abyssinia, which roughly coincides with Ethiopia today. So the Italians wanted to have Mediterranean empire, right? Mussolini saw himself as a successor to the Caesars and so on. And the problem was, well, they didn't have any empire, any province in Africa. So they needed to have a self-respecting emperor, needed to have a province in Africa. So they invaded this poor Abyssinia, which was a very poor country, virtually no army and no resources to exploit, but at least you have a province. And the British and the French didn't take it well. Okay, so they now started diplomatic sanctions against Italy, and so with the Western support vanishing away, Mussolini then turns to Hitler, the only one who still accepts him, who has no bad feelings about the Mediterranean Empire in the south. Okay, and so with Mussolini joining Hitler, then it's clear that, well, Austria suddenly is between two bodies, and the situation becomes more or less untenable. And therefore, so the German pressure on Austria increases, and then finally the German army marches into the country in March 1938. So Mises' plans for a return to the Chamber of Commerce in Austria have to be abandoned, and he stays for this reason in Geneva. But the German march into Austria also deranged his affairs in another respect, namely on a private level, because Mises was just about to marry Margit. Yesterday we said, well, they first met in 1925, and now we have 1938. They finally get married in 1938. Whew, quite a becoming, but, well, of course, it's not very surprising given Mises' views that we have heard about yesterday. But also because of mother. Right? There's still Adele von Mises there, and, well, she didn't take much of a liking to any of his girlfriends before, whom we don't know anything. And by the way, Richard von Mises never got married either. Right? And apparently he started, well, intensifying his relations to his... Well, no, he did get married, but also after the death of the mother only. Okay. So now Adele von Mises dies in April 1937. She dies in April 1937. 8 months later, Ludwig proposes to Margit. Okay. Well, okay, one would say, okay, that's a coincidence. But yeah, I do not really believe this. I believe, and maybe most other people believe this too, that there is a causal connection here. Now, Margaret had waited patiently for him to propose for more than 10 years. 8 months after the death of the mother at Christmas 1937, Ludwig was finally ready. True to himself, he left out all ornamental talk and went on to propose with this habitual concision. Quote, now that's a quote from Margaret from Mises, who recalls this scene. "I cannot go on further. I cannot live without you, darling. Let's get married." Wonderful proposition, right? Margaret was, of course, incredulous and the happiest she had ever been. They lost no time making plans. One of the formalities was the public announcement of their wedding plans 6 weeks before the ceremony. But world events conspired now against their personal happiness, and precisely what we talked about. Adolf Hitler threatened Austrian Chancellor Schuschnigg. Germany would provoke civil war in Austria and invade the country. On extremely short notice, Schuschnigg announced a general referendum on Austria's unification with Germany. So his last-minute attempt to provide a political counterattack. If the referendum had been positive, or as a negative on the unification with Germany, it would have been a political disaster for Hitler internationally, but it never came to this vote. Mises was in town on one of his short visits, probably coming in from a conference he had attended in Venice. In the course of the week, that is the week before Sunday, March 13, 1938, it became clear that the Germans were preparing to invade Austria to prevent the referendum from ever taking place. The cautious Mises knew that he was high on the Nazi enemy list, and he left Vienna either on Thursday or early on Friday, the 11th of March. Not a moment too soon, as it turned out. Because on Friday, the SS chief Heinrich Himmler arrived in Vienna with an advance contingent to arrest the most important adversaries of Hitler and seize their property. 2 days later, on March 13, after the German army had reached Vienna at the end of a triumphant march through the country, a group of men broke into Mises' apartment and searched it. So Mises had maintained an apartment in Vienna, or more precisely because they had strict renting laws. In those days, you could not just preserve all on your own a big apartment as he had. So, especially if you did not live in the country, so he had to give it up. What he did then was to strike a deal with a new renter and said, "Well, okay, I'm giving it to you rather than to somebody else. In exchange, you keep me a room." So Mises had still one room in this apartment in which he kept his library and his other stuff. So some unknown men, well, of course it must be Hitler's men, broke into the apartment on that Sunday and searched it. At the end of March, the Gestapo came, so the German secret police, and took 21 boxes full of Mises' possessions and sealed the apartment when they left. In the fall of 1938, the Gestapo returned and took the rest. They looted everything they could find, the books Mises had lovingly collected over decades, his personal correspondence, paintings, silver, personal and administrative documents, everything, even the laundry. Mises would never see these belongings again and never learn what happened to them. At the end of World War II, the Red Army found his personal files, together with the documents of other prominent enemies of the Nazi regime, in a train that had been abandoned by the Nazis in Bohemia. So a train full of documents. From there, they were sent to a secret archive in Moscow. In 1991, 18 years after Mises' death, they were rediscovered because the existence of the archive was revealed. And today they are a most precious tool for biographers of the great economist. So those who, so far, as I know, two Mises biographers have traveled to Moscow, first Richard Ebeling, and then myself, and that's an unavoidable step for those who want to research this in depth. And we both brought copies of the most relevant documents, and I'm happy to say that I got copies of virtually everything that is important, and we have it here at the Mises Institute. So for future Americans, things, or Westerners, let's say, things are much facilitated. Those who want to continue where I left off, well, they can start here in Auburn, Alabama, stay here for a couple of months and read these documents. So, the marriage could not take place in Vienna. Mises was already out of the country, but Margit was still there, and her children were still there too. So there were a few very dangerous months ahead of them. Their connection to Mises was not generally known, right? So Mises was not driving around with Margit, demonstrating their association and so on. And this was, of course, vital for their survival. Had it been known that they were the girlfriend or fiancée of Ludwig von Mises, they would have been arrested. They would not have been allowed to leave the country. But so they were finally allowed to leave the country and could do this in the spring of 1938. And so finally, on July 6th, 1938, they got married in Geneva, simple civil procedure, no synagogue, no church, no bells, and so on. Simple administrative procedure in the presence of two witnesses, which is interesting for us, Hans Kelsen and Gottfried von Haberler. Okay, so it shows that, okay, there was a strong personal relationship here, a strong personal friendship, despite all things that separated them on an intellectual level. Before we come to speak briefly of Mises' departure from Geneva, we might mention among his the interesting, more interesting intellectual events of those years, the emergence of neoliberalism. It was a new phenomenon in those days. In a way, Mises had acknowledged this some sort of new liberalism already in the 1920s. In one of the chapters that are now contained in the book, Critique of Interventionism, so his analysis of interventionism, he had dealt with the new liberals. Okay, so the neoliberals. These were people who departed from the notion that there was an important difference to be made between economic liberties and civil liberties. Okay, of course, that's the distinction that we still find today in those people who call themselves liberals in the United States or also in England. And what is important, what is most important, are civil liberties, and economic liberties is a completely different chapter. It can be easily dissociated from this. Now, the classical liberals, of course, did not believe in this. And there's a very nice sentence from Condillac who says, civil rights as opposed to economic rights? What gibberish! But so, starting in the late 19th century and then the early 20th century, some people set out to write and to think without considering that that was gibberish. And by the late 1920s and early 1930s, there was a beginning movement that set out. Now, part of this movement extended to the circle of Mises' pupils and acquaintances. In fact, as we have said, Mises had had a very strong impact on several important young thinkers, those who were young in the early 1920s, such as Hayek, Machlob, Haberler, Wilhelm Röpke, Lionel Robbins, and others, who had been brought up in not a, in a neoliberal intellectual environment, but in an outright statist, or shall we say, a socialist environment. So they were brought up with the notion that, well, the government should run more or less everything. There were great disturbances created and problems created by, well, uncontrolled private interests operating in an unfettered market economy and so on. And therefore, the government was necessary was held to intervene and control things, channel activities into more becoming directions. Now, Mises then comes with his treatise on socialism and shows that this tendency is not very becoming either. It's not a good ideal to search for the encompassing state. It's not a good idea to try to establish a socialist economy for all the various reasons that he discussed in socialism. So this then creates a shock, of course, for these young people. And whatever the limitations of Mises' impact are, but in any case, he does one thing. He destroys once and for all this socialist ideal in them. So they no longer long for complete statism. They no longer long for complete socialization as a policy ideal. On the other hand, his impact is not strong enough to completely turn them into classical liberals or libertarians, as we might say today. Right? He does not turn them into adherents of the Manchester School. Complete laissez-faire. Right? Some intermixture. They do not know yet where to go and how to reconcile these different elements. They are convinced socialism does not work. That's what Mises did. On the other hand, they also believe that laissez-faire just creates a lot of problems. Immiseration of the working classes, monopolies, and other nasty things. Okay, so what do we do? We need a new synthesis. Right? And this new synthesis is a third way. Neoliberalism, a new liberalism, not the old Manchester laissez-faire liberalism, but a new liberalism. The solution that emerged in the 1930s was based on an intellectual construct that split the social economy into two elements. First, an institutional framework. And second, the processes that played themselves out within that framework. Well, that's the fundamental setup. You have the framework on the one hand, the institutions, and the processes that play out within the framework. Among these processes, most notably, the pricing process. According to this new creed, government should not meddle with the processes, but it did have to establish and maintain the institutional framework. This set of assumptions is characteristic of what has come to be called neoliberalism. We find a clear expression of the neoliberal worldview in a paper that Hayek wrote in 1935. Commenting on Mises' theory of interventionism, Hayek observes that it did not follow from Mises' argument that the only form of capitalism which can be rationally advocated is that of complete laissez-faire in the old sense. Unquote. He goes on. The recognition of the principle of private property does not by any means necessarily imply that the particular delimitation of the contents of this rights, as determined by the existing laws, are the most appropriate. The question as to which is the most appropriate permanent framework, which will secure the smoothest and most efficient working of competition, is of the greatest importance and one which must be admitted has been sadly neglected by economists. So you not only have a new analytical framework, but you also have a research agenda. Right? So now we've got to think about which kind of institutions precisely do we need? And what kind of institutions should the state create and maintain? And today, of course, for those of you who are economists, we have very similar undertaking in the form of constitutional political economy. And it's nothing but a repetition of this research agenda that emerged in the 1930s. The roots of the neoliberal ideology went back at least to the 1880s and 1890s, when German economists of the historical school and their American disciples became convinced that industrial concentration has harmful effects and required moderation through government intervention. One of the visible consequences of this mindset was the Sherman Act, which to the present day has replaced the power of consumers with that of bureaucrats. In Germany, the philosophy of the third way became pervasive in the Sozialpolitik, the social policy about which you already talked. France followed, invoking the necessity of a third solution, a tierce solution, as did the United States under the New Deal. The first programmatic statements of neoliberalism were published only in the 1930s. Conscious statement of these principles in Germany and the United States. The most influential statement came from Chicago economist Henry Simons, who in 1934 circulated a working paper with the title A Positive Program for Laissez-Faire, in which the word positive indicated that this program justified ample government intervention, whereas classical laissez-faire was a negative program and that it did not provide such a justification. Simons called on government to regulate money and banking, prevent the formation of monopolies, and provide minimum income for the destitute. A departure indeed from laissez-faire liberalism. These ideas perfectly expressed the feelings of a generation of economists who had been raised in a thoroughly statist intellectual environment, but who still knew the teachings of the classical liberals. Hayek, Röpke, Machlup, Friedman, Milton Friedman, Michael Polanyi, Walter Eucken, and many others received their university training and their decisive intellectual impulses during the 1920s and early 1930s. During the later 1930s, they began to acquire more senior positions and would, after World War II, assume intellectual leadership of the right. Their neoliberalism animated the work of the post-war institutions that would stem the tide of growing statism, in particular, the Mont Pelerin Society and the Institute for Economic Affairs in London. In more recent years, the neoliberal agenda is carried forward by a new wave of educational institutions, such as the Institute for Humane Studies, the Cato Institute, and the Atlas Research Institution. Now we'll talk tomorrow a little bit more, not much more, but a little bit more about the Mont Pelerin Society. And we'll see that the history of the Mont Pelerin Society, especially in the early years, in the first 20 years or so, consisted essentially of the confrontation between Manchester liberals of Mises's brand and neoliberals. And that was the history of the early Mont Pelerin Society. And so it is for us, of course, very important to see institutions that emerged after World War II. They had this new liberal inspiration and promoted this and spread this message. And the question is, how did laissez-faire liberalism survive? And here Mises indeed played a central role. And the institutions that supported him, though much less powerful, much less important than the neoliberal institutions, still had an impact and, provided the ground on which in the past 25 years the Mises Institute has been and similar institutions have been operating. Now, there are other things that we might mention about the Geneva years, but we'll cut short here, and I'll briefly narrate for you the circumstances of Mises' departure from Geneva. It occurred in 1940, roughly 8 or 10 months after the war, the Second World War had broken out, which was at first a very strange war, in case from the point of view of Western Europe, because nothing happened on the Western Front. Okay. The war breaks out in September 1939. There are no hostile activity, no fighting, nothing on the Western Front for 9 months until May 1940. And the reason, so why don't the Western armies invade Germany? Germany is busy with the Poles, it's crushing the Polish army and so on. Why don't they use this in attack from the West? Well, because by and large, they are demoralized. Right? World War I did not really settle international relations. It did not give the world peace. It just created resentment and so on. And several studies in the interwar period had explained to the French and to the British that by and large, they had been lured into a destructive war for the interests of various small minorities. So they are unwilling now to, again, risk their neck to save Eastern Europe, and nothing happens on the Western Front. Mises still explores the possibility of moving to the U.S., principally at the behest of his wife. Still gets a little bit nervous, right? Who knows what can happen? And he did so in correspondence with his brother Richard and Fritz Machlup, both of whom had already crossed the Atlantic. So Richard had a chair at the University of Berlin until 1933 when Hitler came to power. Then he had to leave. He went to Turkey, taught in Istanbul for 6 years. And then in the fall, summer 1939, he left for the United States, for Harvard. And Machlup had already been in the U.S. Since 1935, at least. Since 1935, he had a full professorship at Buffalo, at the University of Buffalo, which was, by the way, also a Rockefeller creation. Machlup had discussed the idea of a California vacation for Mises with Benjamin Anderson and other friends from the University of California. Anderson had just moved to the Los Angeles campus of the University of California and was the most influential man in the hitherto unprestigious Department of Economics. UCLA showed interest, and the chairman of the department wrote two letters to Machlup, who then mediated between the two parties. So Mises almost would have gone to UCLA, and things would have turned out very, very different had he done so in 1939. But in this process of negotiation with correspondence, things got mixed up. At first, Mises declined the proposition when Machlup told him UCLA could offer only a comparatively low salary. Machlup's guess was UCLA could pay at most $4,000 per annum. Now, this compares this to the $8,200 that Mises says in Switzerland. As compared to this, of course, it was not much, but it was, in fact, ultimately turns out to be the double of what he finally got when he arrived in the United States. Right? When he, a year later, when he had to go anyway, he got finally a stipend of $2,000. So even from that point of view, it was a bad decision, bad entrepreneurial decision. Yeah. Mises asked his friend Machlup to tell Dudley Pegram, the chair of the department, that his Austrian passport had expired and that he could therefore not accept the offer at the moment and would be grateful if the invitation could be postponed a year. While Mises' letter was on its way, Machlup wrote again, this time pointing out that an invitation from UCLA would procure you with a permanent non-quota immigration visa for the United States, which might be considered an asset these days. Okay, so in other words, Mises would not have been a temporary visa, but a permanent visa. And that indeed was an asset in these days. This convinced Mises. Meanwhile, he had received a cable from his friend Unger, a former Geneva student of his, who was already in New York City and who told him in telegraphic language, I need to find my page again. That, in any case, that Mises was making a mistake. That's what he told him. Yeah, Mises was making a mistake. As soon as he received Machlup's letter on February 28, 1940, Mises wrote back that his concerns about passport and visa question had been dispelled and that he would be ready to go to California. Now, if he had cabled this message to Machlup, Mises might have begun a career in California in August 1940, and history would indeed have been different. But Mises sent the letter by surface mail, or as we say today, snail mail. And it reached Machlup only after he had already declined the offer on Mises' behalf. When Maclob wrote to Anderson, trying as diplomatically as he could to reopen the negotiations, he received a response from Anderson's secretary that her boss was on a short vacation. 1 month later, Pegram, Anderson's boss, gave a definite no. Now, the next thing that happens is May 1940. In May 1940, the German army creates what in Mises' eyes was a military wonder, military miracle. Because Mises was firmly convinced that World War II would start just as World War I had ended, namely in the trenches. Would be a very static front, and well, people would be killing themselves and maybe bomb things and so on, but that would by and large be it. The Germans could not overcome the Maginot Line, the defense line that had been established by the French in the interwar years, very heavily fortified. But meanwhile, well, there was technological progress, most notably in the form of aviation, military aviation, and several new military theoreticians had worked out plans, especially during the 1930s, how to overcome such defense lines. And this new strategy was based on speed, speed that could be realized with the help of planes, but also of tanks. And that's what the Germans did. Right? So they had this very nice French defense plan was based on old technology, right? And could not withstand the attack of very quickly moving troops, as in the case of the tank divisions of General Guderian, Heinz Guderian, so who broke through the French and British lines and cut off their supply lines, and overran France in May 1940. And when you look at Mises' diary of those days, it's you see the shock, right? Yes. As always, exclamation marks, puts in whatever, Brussels exclamation mark, and Paris exclamation mark, and so on. Well, so he later said that May 1940 was the most catastrophic month in European history, possibly in the impact that it had on him personally. So now it was clear that he had to leave, in any case for him, not necessarily for all of his colleagues. Kelsen and Röpke were essentially in the same position. Röpke was good. He was not a Jew, but he was also very high on the Nazi enemy list. And then finally, Kelsen and Mises left. Röpke stayed. Kelsen was much better organized, prepared than Mises. He managed to get the last plane leaving from Switzerland to Spain, and from Spain to Portugal, and took the ship over the Atlantic, and Mises did not do this. This started his preparations too late, and the question was, should I stay or should I go? Röpke finally stayed, and it turned out to be a viable choice because the Nazis never invaded Switzerland. The school maintained its operations, so Mises could have stayed there, right? Could have survived the war. But then, of course, as we know, history would have been very different. Probably we would not be in this room here today. The Mises Institute would probably not exist. Mises would have continued writing in German. Somebody might have translated more of his books into English. Who knows? But in any case, he would never have had a school of students as he had in New York in the 1950s, in the early 1960s. There would never have been a human action movement such as the one that we will describe tomorrow. So Mises decides to leave Austria, and it was a rather adventurous escape, at which at one point, well, there was risk they would be caught by the Nazi troops that were not then invading southern France. But, well, they managed to get through the lines and then took, on July 25th, took a ship to the United States from Lisbon, a ship with the name Europe, right, and leave for the United States. And Mises would return to Europe only 7 years later, in 1947, when he attended the first Mont Pelerin Society meeting in Switzerland again. Okay, I'll stop here and give you time for questions. Why are his personal documents still in Moscow? Well, because the Russians would not surrender it. Okay, all these documents are still in the secret archive. For me, of course, I was interested in Mises, and there are also documents from Ottmar Spangenberg, for example, from the Adlers, various other, many Jewish intellectuals, but also, regime opponents in general. And the Russians were interested in this, to understand the personal relationships, connections between various opposition groups and the Nazis. And, of course, they wanted to use this material to exercise pressure, maybe blackmail people and so on. But there's also other stuff. For example, there are administrative documents from the Auschwitz concentration camp there. Okay, and that was, in fact, the number one item that most researchers were interested in. When I came to Moscow, I said, I want to see the Mises papers. Okay, here are the Mises papers. And they looked at me, nothing else? I could not believe that I came just for this Austrian economist. I thought I was interested in some of the more sexy stuff. For example, the diaries, the Goebbels diaries, were published a few years ago, were discovered by David Irving, the British historian, there, and then published. So they have all this, and I'm not quite sure whether they fully exploited the archive, or there are other treasures to be discovered. I don't know. I only researched the Mises stuff and looked at every single item. And there were a few things that I could not bring. For example, to mention one thing that could be interesting for the history of economics in Austria, there are copies of the doctoral dissertations of some of the female students who wrote under Mises in the late 1910s. For example, there's a doctoral dissertation by Helene Lisa. There's a copy in this archive. So somebody writing the history of, female economists in Austria would have to go there and look this up, unless he can find a copy somewhere in Vienna. So the Russians have no intention of giving up this thing, just as various museums in various countries have no interest of surrendering the treasures of art that they have by various means acquired in other countries. Yep.
What about his books?
Yeah, the books. We know something about the books. The books have been brought to a central library that was called the Judenbibliothek, the Jewish library, and was located in Berlin. So Mises' books have certainly been brought to this library, and from there they were lent out and brought back to various other libraries within the country. And then at the end of the year vanished, right, in circumstances that are described in a paper that I quote in this chapter. So then later on, Mises knew that some of his books turned up in used bookshops. Okay, so he knew this because it was this inscription and so on, but he was not quite sure exactly how they ended up there. But today we know that there was this Judenbibliothek. So the books were first brought to Germany, and from there on, then also sold to other people to finance part of the war and so on. Yep.
Is there any evidence, like in his personal correspondence, of like a sort of particular like lamentation of like the fate of the Jews specifically in Europe? I mean, he was obviously outraged at the entire totality, but I mean, is there any?
The question is, did Mises lament the fate of the Jews in correspondence or so? No, I mean, lamentation was not his style. No, he would never lament, would never complain. Sometimes, I mean, when he said anything approaching this, it would be rather ironic. In one of his letters, he said, you cannot deny it. He didn't quite say it that way. I'm an old chap. I'm a contemporary of Wilhelm I and Karl Marx. So what do you want? Cannot change this. No, he never really lamented this, but he sometimes expressed outrage, occasionally. And I said, so these were monsters who killed decent people and so on, or tortured them. Yeah, but that's very rare. So that's what you find in some letters to former acquaintances or friends in Vienna, but never with his friends in the U.S. Now, I have, of course, I have only the correspondence. I mean, it's a completely different story what went on in personal discussions and so on. But this I cannot tell. Yeah, there were other questions? Yeah.
You were speaking a little bit in this period to the distinction between what was called a new liberalism at that time, and I guess it's not clear to me what its relationship is to what we call classical liberalism. And today we have this term neoliberalism, which is thrown around, and it's not clear to me how that's separate from neoconservatism or not. So this whole neoliberalism is a very elusive term, and then you say that there's a separation in neoliberalism of civil liberties and economic liberties, which classical liberalism would reject, as I understand you saying.
Yes.
And what I'm more interested in is, could you concisely make a statement as to what is the self-governing character of civil liberties, right? When it's joined with economic liberties, what's the tasks of our civil liberties?
Okay, so these are many questions. Okay, let me start with this history of thought aspects. Neoliberalism, from the point of those who understood themselves to be neoliberals, those who emerged in the 1930s, meant what I described before, a third way, a combination of liberty, economic liberty, as concerned, as embodied in the pricing process of the market, and on the other hand, the creation and maintenance of an institutional framework, which was the task of the government. That's the government. Okay. Now, that is how the neoliberals perceive themselves. And I think that's a fair description of what the novelty was. So they really were trying to forge a third way. And of course, I mean, we're now today in the 18th generation of third way policies. But they not always have the same characteristics that I described before. But what is common to all of them is, of course, that you somehow want to explain where you have both liberty and some role for government intervention. You need to have a theory that explains to you where precisely government needs to intervene beyond a laissez-faire agenda. Right? Again, for Adam Smith, you just have defense, suppression of crime, and public goods, a few public goods. Right? And today, of course, much more ample. Now, neoliberalism, as used in some circles today, especially left-wing writers, means something different. Not necessarily the same thing. It means, well, there are some liberals, or some classical liberals. There's people who believe that the government should not run everything. Okay? So it's an expression of their shock. Right? We thought we got rid of these guys, and here they are anew. So there is a new liberalism. That's what they mean, and they are just starting now in various countries because many of them are very lazy, so they didn't do their homework for a long time. They are starting now to see the finer distinctions between the different groups. So what we call Manchester liberals and neoliberals or anarcho-capitalists and so on. These are different groups. Do not necessarily share the same analytical framework and the same political agenda. Okay, then what was the last question again?
Well, if the neoliberals are just arguing for, well, whoever the new liberals are, if they're advocating for separation of civil liberties from economic liberties, and you would say that the classical liberal position is that is absurd.
Yeah.
Then what does self-government look like when you bring civil liberties and economic liberties together as a concept?
When you bring, does a government look like when you bring economic liberties and civil liberties together? I'm not quite sure that I understand the question. I will answer in a different way. Maybe this will bring us closer. The reason why classical liberals do not believe it's meaningful to make this distinction is because any true liberty presupposes some autonomous control over real resources. So if the government owns all real resources, if you have a complete socialist state, and you say, okay, in this case we have no economic liberties, but you still have civil liberties, then the question is, how can this be? How can you have, for example, freedom of expression? That's the point that Mises made, starting in the 1920s. How can you have liberty of expression if the government runs all the printing presses? Or let's say today, if the government was exclusive one institution to give access to the internet. you could have none, right? And so it's not meaningful to make this this net. You cannot separate economic liberties from civil liberties. Economic liberties are unavoidable. It's rather the other way around, right? In some cases, you would say you have economic liberties, but you take away some of the so-called civil liberties. You suppress some uses of private property in an interventionist regime. Right? You say, okay, you can own what you want, but you cannot say what you want, which is the case in many European countries today, right? We have limited freedom of expression. But so in general, then the question is, how can you guarantee these rights or these liberties? How can you enforce them? How can you protect them? That's a different question. Here the classical liberals answer, well, you need a government for this. Okay, because there is, in economic jargon, market failure in security production. The anarcho-capitalists answer, well, you do not need government for this. The protection of property rights and therefore the protection of civil liberties and of economic liberties can be ensured by the market process itself. This is firms working with a profit incentive, but also private individuals and non-profit organizations. They all can take part in this protection process. Other questions? Yeah?
Yeah, I listened to a short snippet of the recording of Mises. How much recorded class work remains?
I'm aware of only two tapes. So this is one, and I think we'll try to listen to the other one tomorrow. I mean, the quality was not very good. We'll try to work on this a little bit. So the other one is about 4 years later, early 1962, and we will use this to see how he became more frail just in the mere space of 4 years. But apart from these two tapes, there are no other ones that I knew of. No film documents either. We have many photos. There must be many more photos from the 1920s and 1930s if you go to newspaper archives, which I did not do. And so there's ample room for people coming after me to make viable contributions. I did not do this, but I'm sure if you go to the Berliner Zeitung or Neue Freie Presse archives, you will find more stuff. No other question? Okay, thank you very much for your attention.